I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Helene Wecker, the author of the fine new novel, The Golem and the Genie. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Normally, we congregational rabbis know our own congregation's experiences best and rarely have the chance to experience Jewish religious services anywhere else. That's because, sort of obviously, we're typically conducting services on Friday night and Saturday morning when everybody else is doing their own best work. Tied as we are to our home bases and conducting as many services as we do, when we have a Sabbath off, we tend to spend it with our families rather than attending another service somewhere else. And that's a bit of a shame. It means that when we go to conventions or conferences over a weekend, we are often surprised at what we find in those experiences, that we can easily get locked into doing the same sort of thing with the same music every week. Pirkei Avot, the great tractate of ethics in the Mishnah, warns us against this, saying, Al tas tfilatcha keva, don't allow your prayers to become routine. But so much of the time, that's exactly what occurs. We do the same stuff every week, use the same melodies, and think that familiarity is the same thing as inspiration. So I've always made it a practice to attend Shabbat services somewhere else whenever I can. I do this both in my own city of Tucson, Arizona, when I have flexibility in my schedule, you know, like the second day of a Jewish holiday observed as a festival by conservative and Orthodox Jews, but generally not by my own Reform movement, or when I happen to have a Shabbat evening or morning off. This occurs very rarely, however, perhaps a few times a year, since the extra festival day sometimes coincides with religious school or another event in my own temple, and I'm off on Friday or Saturday very infrequently, as you might imagine. So most of my religious tourism takes place when I am on an actual tour, that is, vacation in another city or country. And that has certainly led to some wonderful experiences that have enhanced my knowledge and depth as a rabbi, as well as led to some positive changes in how we do services at my own home congregation. I've learned new melodies, new customs, seen interesting and good ways to do what we do on a weekly basis. Last Shabbat, I had the opportunity to attend services at Temple Israel in Boston, Massachusetts, another of the flagship Reform Movement synagogues in this country. In the past 10 months, on those few Sabbaths when I've not been conducting services at my own Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, I've gone to Temple at significant congregations in Los Angeles, New York, and now Boston. All the services were during my vacations. Talk about a busman's holiday. And all took place over holiday periods, this last on the Friday evening of Memorial Day. While this was a pretty anecdotal and limited experience, I learned interesting things. In those three cities, spread out from last 4th of July to this Memorial Day, at Stephen S. Wise Temple in Bel Air, California, Congregation B'nai Jeshurun, Central Synagogue and Temple Emmanuel in Manhattan, and at Temple Israel in Boston, there were some differences between the services, but more similarities. All had outstanding musicians creating the Shabbat sound, using guitar, piano, clarinet, saxophone, sometimes violin. All the cantors and other singers were quite talented. The rabbis spoke well, and each service, except Emmanuel in New York, had a kind of studied informality. That is, they were all carefully orchestrated to seem sort of relaxed in a structured way. None were particularly long, and while they used different prayer books, the actual prayers were pretty darn similar. These are significant temples, all with tremendous financial resources and great clergy stability, none with fewer than 1,800 family memberships in major metropolitan centers. All have been cited in publications, not only Jewish ones, but also Newsweek, as being among the most vibrant and excellent synagogues in America. And while this was a very limited exposure, we went to one service at each shul, every one during a holiday weekend, there were three common themes. First, the age of the congregants at these services was best described as, mature. The shulgoers at liberal synagogues, reform and conservative temples both, are mostly in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s. They clearly enjoy the services, but just as clearly, they have not succeeded in convincing their children and grandchildren that attending shul Friday or Saturday should be an important part of their lifestyles. While my wife and I weren't the youngest people at any of these shuls, we were certainly on the younger side. And I am 52 years old, and even if she is quite a bit younger. Well, that doesn't appear to bode well for the ultimate direction of American liberal Judaism. Secondly, music was the featured attraction at all these services, extremely well played and arranged and performed, and filling the bulk of the service, sometimes almost the whole experience except for a sermon and the memorial prayers and announcements. The actual melodies ranged from old Jewish folk standards to neo-Hasidic tunes to Israeli melodies to light elevator music, I would say, to some more interesting rhythmic pieces. The general feeling was somewhere between pop rock and adult contemporary, with just a bit of leftover 60s folky stuff in the reform tunes and some klezmer and cantorial-flavored sounds, both in the conservative and a little bit in the reform. The music was generally pleasant, and as you would expect in great musical cities like New York, Boston, and L.A., played by excellent musicians using fine arrangements in a very professional manner. But third, and most significantly, the largest crowd in any of these temples was not over 125 people. And this was in congregations that have memberships that range from 1,800 to 3,000 families, which translates to between 4,000 and 7,000 people, in cities with huge Jewish populations, ranging from a couple of 100,000 in the Boston area to 600,000 in the LA area to over 2 million in the New York megalopolis. You can understand these services were on holiday weekends, that is American holiday weekends, not Jewish holidays, and not everybody who usually comes was there, I'm sure. But still, an attendance of 100 to 125 people in these mega temples for Shabbat services is stunningly low. That means that, basically, they have a market penetration for service attendance among their own membership that is between 2 and 3%. Or in simple terms, 97 or 98 out of every 100 members of these congregations did not attend Shabbat services when we were there. And that says nothing about all the unaffiliated Jews who also didn't attend. Mind you, there were at least two and often three, four sometimes, full-time rabbis and cantors leading each of these services. To give you a baseline, 125 congregants is approximately what we attract on a slow Friday night at my own Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, where there are at most 30,000 Jews in the whole city, and where our membership is roughly one-third to one-fifth the size of these great synagogues. In other words, we're drawing a Shabbat attendance that's closer to 10% of our congregation, not real impressive, but 3 to 5 times greater in proportion than these famous temples are drawing from a much larger Jewish population base. Which makes me wonder just what we can expect in the future. If the most innovative, creative worship efforts of our finest synagogues in our major Jewish cities are producing essentially small crowds representing a tiny proportion of their affiliated membership on Shabbat, and if their best efforts are just not bringing people in the door, and certainly not bringing young people in the door, what's next? I am in general an optimist about Judaism, and American Judaism in particular, but clearly this situation is unsustainable. It cannot go on forever. This doesn't mean in any way that Jewish life in the U.S. is dying. You know, you could make the case it's actually more vibrant than any time in history. But it does mean that the only institution that guarantees true perpetuation of Judaism in the future, the synagogue, has serious troubles to address, and that what are theoretically the best of these synagogues are not doing anything that's fixing the problem. And no one really has an answer to what will bring people into services, or certainly what will bring younger Jews and their partners in the door and keep them coming. Meaning that we need to try some things we aren't currently trying. And the innovations we need may not come from the major Jewish cities or from the famous congregations. On this theme of trying new ideas and trends, and to play us in on the theme of Shabbat, here's a cut from the new and wonderful CD Armon Bizman by Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw. It's their version of the prayer Baruch Hu, the call to prayer. That was Baruch Hu from Armon Bizman, the call to prayer, from their new Friday night service created by Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw. Perhaps that can be part of the answer to this problem. When we come back on Two Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest, Helene Wecker, the author of the terrific first novel, The Golem and the Genie, which combines elements from Jewish and Muslim magical traditions, when we come back on Two Jewish.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Helene Wecker. She has a new book out called The Golem and the Genie. It is her first novel. It is inventive, clever, interesting, and besides that, I really liked it. And a mixture of, how can I say this, Jewish and Arab and all kinds of interesting traditions having to do with mysticism, and yet it's all a novel set in the beginning of the 20th century in America. So welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell me a little bit about how you came up with the idea. There have been a lot of Golem stories, obviously, over the years. This is the first one I know that includes a genie.
It was the first one that I'd heard of, too. I've heard since of a book, I haven't read the Bartimaeus trilogy, that includes a golem and a genie, but they don't interact and they're not the main characters in this way. The way that I came to this book was that I was at Columbia University and I was working on a collection of linked short stories that I was writing for the Masters of Writing program that I was in at the time. And the stories were from my family and from my husband's family, and I'm Jewish and he's Arab American. And I wasn't having that much success with them. A couple of them were okay. The rest of them were not terribly good. And part of it was that I just wasn't a very good writer at that point. I was very new at it. And they were like very realist stories. And I was talking to a friend of mine about it who was in the workshop with me, and she said, "Helene, you're a total geek. This is, which is true. I grew up like, you know, on Star Trek and Star Wars and Doctor Who and Tolkien and Asimov and Bradbury and all that." And she said, "This is, you're always talking about using genre elements in literary fiction. How come you're not writing like that?" And it honestly had never occurred to me. So I just sort of took that idea and said, okay, what if instead of the Jewish girl and the Arab American boy, what if it's a golem and a genie, sort of taking like the two sort of folkloric stand-ins. And it sort of jumped off from there and developed a life of its own, and the characters pretty quickly sort of became less about stand-ins for two real people and became real people themselves. At least, you know, as far as character development and you know, sort of forming a book around them went. And that's sort of how it happened.
Boy, they became real people themselves, almost like a golem and a genie become.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
We will talk much more with Helene Wecker and discuss her very interesting book, The Golem and the Genie, when we come back in a few moments on Two Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich.
As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetrick Fell, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelber, to the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been talking about the educational systems in the United States and in Israel, but particularly Israel, of course, talking about colleges and how Israeli students begin after Army service, military service of some kind, and then begin college. They're more mature. Tell me a little bit about the different kinds of colleges and universities in Israel. 70% of Israelis take at least a first degree. That is what we would consider a bachelor's, I suppose, here. Mm-hmm. How do you get into college? How difficult it is it? How expensive is it? What are the different kind of tracks?
Okay, so the first track that is considered more prestige, I would say, in Israel are the main universities.
Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
Like the Hebrew University, the Technion in Haifa, the University of Haifa, University of Be'er Sheva, University of Tel Aviv, Bar Ilan. Okay. Those universities are heavily subsidized by the government. So at the end, you end up paying a tuition of around $3,000 a year. That's the whole cost, the tuition. And they are very high quality.
A little bit less than in the States.
Definitely. And they are very, very high quality, and they are considered, the Technion, if I remember correctly, is at the top 50 list of the world, and the University of Jerusalem, the Hebrew University, is also, I think, at the top 80 or 90, and the Tel Aviv University is somewhere between the 90 and 100 on the international top universities of the world. So there, it's a very high-end and high-quality education. Through the universities. The other options are colleges. Colleges are not as heavily subsidized, so the tuition would be around $10,000 a year. Still modest by modern standards,
to
the
right.
United States. By the way, anyone who is doing Aliyah to Israel from the States at that age would receive coverage for his first degree from the government of Israel.
So basically free education.
Free education through
your bachelor's.
So that's, you know, that's outstanding. As for the routes of learning, usually if you are going on more scientific and I would say more engineering roles, the first degree would be Bachelor's of Science, which will take 4 years of learning. If you're more at the arts area, history, social studies, those programs are usually 3 years long. Of course, those programs, usually if you want to really use them later on for a career, you would need to do, a graduate degree of some sort and maybe even a PhD. While with engineering, you can usually...
Bachelor's is enough. You can go to work right away.
You can be an engineer anywhere, yeah.
So people in the high-tech field, if they didn't get to the Technion, would go to one of these colleges of engineering, or would they... What's their access? Because that's obviously the biggest, the fastest growing sector of the Israeli economy.
Right. So the Technion would be the main university to go for engineering, but also the Tel Aviv University is very strong. Be'er Sheva University, the Hebrew University also have significant parts. And also some of the colleges. Of course, at the end of the day, when you come to, and I guess it's like here, when you come to an interview, your employer will have their own bias. And will look at where you learned, what grades you achieved, did you work along your work. It's very common, especially in engineering, that people start working very early on their studies. I already worked at the high-tech industry when I was on my second semester out of eight. So it's very common and it's very significant, because then your future employer looks and says, oh, wow, you have already 3 years of experience right. working alongside your studies. And people know how hard it is to do both at the same time.
So kind of like here in that way.
Kind of like here.
Guy, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
It's vacation season now that we're into June. You are, I think, the absolute expert in the world on Jewish places to go that people haven't thought about either as Jewish places or with interesting Jewish sites. Where would you go on vacation that people don't think about as having Jewish qualities?
Well, two areas that are sort of interesting, I think, are some of the oldest Jewish settlements in the New World. We once talked about Curacao when I went to a wedding there, which has the oldest continuously functioning synagogue in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, from like the 16th century.
Yeah, and there are several islands in the Caribbean that are deeply connected to Jewish history, the history of the expulsion from Spain, the arrival of the Jews into the Netherlands and England as Protestant countries, which welcomed them. The early colonists being accompanied by Jews who, for a while, were key in developing the chocolate trade and the cocoa industry, which proved to be a small but important part of the colonial economy in the New World. So there's a whole bunch of islands that have interesting Jewish histories and synagogues to visit. But there's also Recife, which is the easternmost corner of Brazil, which is, some would argue, the first Jewish community in the New World and still has a Jewish community. You can still get kosher food there. And it's a fascinating and little visit. I mean, most people, if they go to Brazil, they either go to Sao Paulo or Rio. They don't think about Recife. And Recife deserves a second look because it's more tropical, it's equatorial, it's closer to Africa in many ways, culturally and whatever. And it has an important chunk of Jewish history.
You know, it's from Recife that the Jews of New York got started, actually. That's where they sailed from when they ended up founding in, 300 years ago, 350 years ago now, 350 years ago, the Jewish community in New York.
Ironically, that means the biggest Jewish community in the world, which is New York,
right,
stems from this tiny
little
old
corner
Jewish community in Recife.
Right. I remember going to a synagogue in St. Thomas with a sand floor. You know, those are always fun, and there's a number of them around the Caribbean.
Right. The one in Curacao has this white sand, and it comes from the, as you know, the pasuk about your descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the heaven and the sands on the seashore. So the Caribbean Jews took that literally, and they had these beautiful tropical hardwood floors, which they covered with white sand in a reference to the importance of keeping the covenant. And, you know, there's a whole interesting discussion we could have some other time about what does it mean to keep the covenant, and how do we as Jews today feel bound or not bound by the covenant, which is symbolized by those grains of sand on the floor throughout the Caribbean.
Wonderful synagogues to visit, wonderful places to go. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris is asked to take his wife Ruth and her mother Estelle to the doctor's office for an exam for Estelle. But almost as soon as he puts the car into gear, Ruth shouts at him, "Morris, you're going too slow. We'll be late. Hurry up." A minute later, Estelle shouts, "Morris, slow down. You're too fast." A few minutes later, Ruth shouts, "Morris, stay in your lane. Get closer to the curb." And a moment later, Estelle shouts, "Morris, you're too close to the curb. You'll hit it." Then Ruth shouts, "Morris, turn on the radio. We need some music." As soon as he does, Estelle shouts, "Morris, I don't like the radio. Peace and quiet in the car. Shut it off." Finally, Morris says, "Ruth, who is driving this car? You or your mother?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and drive safely. And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's events, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a bad report. "We aren't strong enough to conquer the land." Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. But the rebellion fails and a verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith in God is at the heart of the problem, and God decides that this generation can never come into the Holy Land and will have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone, and a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth and untainted by slavery or its mentality, can come forward. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. He accuses them of hubris, of chutzpah, of overweening pride and egotism. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own. "Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us?" he asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundations of the Israelites' leadership, for if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery, as some propose now to do. But Korach dissembles, that is, he lies. For Moses clearly has had no great desire for his high office, but has held it as a sacred trust given him by God. Korach threatens God's authority, not Moses. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match, and the net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed, while Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. You know, it's always nice when God has your back. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. But the even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, and which is focused on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion can we reach our own promised land. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Helene Wecker, will explain what a golem has in common with a genie, and which one might make a better TV series. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now event priced at just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The civil war in Syria continues to develop further complications for Israel. Syrian President Bashar Assad said Russia has now delivered an advanced air defense system to his civil war-torn country. Assad made the announcement during an interview with a Hezbollah-controlled Al-Manar television network in Lebanon. S-300 missiles would significantly boost Syria's ability to stave off international intervention in the civil war. The Assad government has been seeking to purchase the advanced batteries, which can intercept manned aircraft and guided missiles from Moscow, for many years. Syria has been making payments on a 2010 agreement with Moscow to buy four of them for $900 million. This is on information provided by Israel. Israel and the U.S. have called on Russian leaders to halt the sale in order to allow the option of intervention in the civil war, and because of the threat they pose to Israel. Assad reiterated that the Syrian army would strike back at Israel if it attacked Syrian territory, although it didn't a couple of weeks ago. Assad also said that his government would not prevent any Arab group in Syria from working to liberate the Golan Heights from Israeli control. 2 days before Assad confirmed that Russia had made good on the deal, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said that Israel would react forcefully if Syria actually took delivery of the missiles. "The deliveries have not taken place, and I hope they do not," he said. "But if by misfortune they arrive in Syria, we will know what to do." In other news, a letter handwritten by Alfred Dreyfus, the French Jewish army captain who was wrongly convicted of treason in 1894, was sold at an auction for nearly $500,000. The letter, which Dreyfus sent from prison to government officials in an attempt to clear his name, was sold for $492,000 at an auction organized by Sotheby's Paris branch. It was not expected to bring in more than $190,000. Due to Sotheby's privacy policy, French media will not report the names of the seller or buyer. But, according to reports, the buyer participated in the auction over the phone, outbidding several interested parties. Dreyfus's grandson, Charles Dreyfus, wrote an open letter last week urging the seller not to sell, but instead to give the letter to a museum. The letter was probably given by Pierre Dreyfus, the son of Alfred, to the National French Library for safekeeping in May of 1940, so that they could protect it from the German occupation, Sotheby's said. The letter was returned to the Dreyfus family in 1951 and bought by the person who sold it at Sotheby's in 1996. Captain in the French army, Alfred Dreyfus was exonerated in 1906 of his conviction on charges of spying for Germany after a lengthy court battle rife with anti-Semitism. Historians describe it as a determinant of modern Zionism and a major influence on Theodor Herzl, the Austrian journalist who covered the trial and shortly thereafter founded the World Zionist Congress. The case was widely denounced as a miscarriage of justice, most notably in Jacques, the open letter by Emile Zola published in 1898 on the front page of the French newspaper L'Aurore. It was the most celebrated court case of the 19th century and led directly to the creation of the modern Zionist movement by Herzl, which led to the founding of the State of Israel. And on the lighter side, what's a nice, non-famous Jewish boy like Jake Davidson doing with a very famous model actress like Kate Upton? Davidson, a senior at a Jewish day school in Bel Air, California, asked Upton to be his prom date back in March via a YouTube video that went viral and ultimately landed him on the Today Show.
"I'm Jewish, 5'9 on a really good day, and I can't dance at all. You're Christian, 5'10, and that Cat Daddy video should have won an Oscar for Best Short Film. You could say this is destiny."
At first, it seemed like he actually might have a shot.
Upton called into the Today Show, stating she'd love to go, but had to check her calendar.
Jake, make your pitch. This is the time. Make your pitch.
Kit, I'm telling you, it'll be a great night, great evening. I could even get the curfew extended, hopefully, talk to some of my parents, maybe. I could go great dinner before. I'd hope you'd be interested if your schedule's free. And what time should I pick you up if you're interested?
Kate?
Well, I definitely have to just check my schedule, but you seem like so much fun, and if everything works out, I'd love to go with you. I know we'd have a blast. Right.
I know we would. Thank you.
Alas, in the end, Kate Upton was tied up in New York shooting The Other Women, a comedy starring Cameron Diaz, Nicki Minaj, and Leslie Mann. But don't feel too badly for young Jake Davidson. The Milken Community High School of Stephen S. Wise Temple's prom was last week, and Davidson was there with a pretty good runner-up, Danish-born Sports Illustrated model Nina Agdal. She reached out to Davidson after she learned of his rejection. Sounds like Agdal doesn't regret her decision. Had such a great prom night. Thank you, Jake Davidson, 23, for being an awesome date, she tweeted after the dance. For tips on getting a date with a supermodel for your very own Jewish day school prom, please refer to Davidson's very funny video on YouTube. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. She's a first-time novelist, Helene Wecker. She got her BA from Carleton College in Minnesota, a master's from Columbia in New York. Her book is called The Golem and the Genie. As we said a little bit earlier this morning, sort of the first book that I can remember that combines these two remarkable mythical characters, coming to some degree out of her own background. So let's talk a little bit about Golem stories. You must have researched some of the other Golem, the origin of the Golem story, how it all plays out, because you have all the elements here. Tell us a little bit about what attracted to you.
I think what attracted me to the Golem stories was sort of the idea of what happens when we try to create life that is close to human but not quite. What's lost in that gap between almost human and completely human, what's lost or what changes or what sort of stands out. And it's a theme that I think has been examined so many different ways over the years, you know, and everything from, you know, the Frankenstein to, you know, modern science fiction and fantasy, everything from, Star Trek, you know, Commander Data, the android, to Blade Runner with the replicants, and any number of android and robot stories. And I find it sort of perpetually fascinating. And the idea that, you know, even way back in medieval times, that this story still had so many, had so much power, and, you know, going all the way back, you know, I'm not even clear when, you know, of course there's, you know, Rabbi Lowe and the Golem of Prague, medieval Prague, but, you know, how far back do the Golem stories go, and how far back do any of these stories go in any of the traditions? It seems like a question that's always been there with us.
You know, it's a fascinating question, of course, and you note how it's played out in science fiction, and the whole concept of technology run amok, taking over our lives. In the Golem story, sometimes the Golem turns on its creator late in the game, but usually the creator knows the magical way to kill it, as in the Golem of Prague. I think yours is the first story I can recall where the Golem is sort of left adrift from the very beginning, almost.
Yeah, there don't seem to be that many Golem tales where the Golem doesn't, where it's either told from the Golem's point of view or the Golem's creator has sort of left the scene. Usually it's like that tandem, that pairing. And so the idea of the Golem on her own, almost, you know, like the masterless servant, was both fascinating and also made her a better character, I think, especially as far as a book like this would go. That, you know, here she is, she's coming up against her limitations, but also just sort of rudderless. And as far as, you know, making about an immigration story in a stranger in a strange land, there didn't seem to be a better way to just sort of toss her in the deep end of the pool and see what she would do.
It, you know, it made it a very interesting sort of development of personality story, too. So tell us about the genie and doing research on that. And, I mean, did you just talk to your husband? How did it work?
No, I did the same sort of research process for the genie that I did for the golem, and a lot of looking up the old stories and reading, you know, various versions of the Thousand and One Nights tales. And, you know, I think certainly in American culture, jinn and genies, you know, are a little more prevalent than golems, more in sort of a watered-down, westernized version. You know, I Dream of Genie and you know, the Aladdin movie with Robin Williams, Big Blue Robin Williams. But I think there's more sort of preconceived notions about that. So I had to go back and take a look at the original tales. And what I found was just an insane number of variations. And after a while of sort of my brain twisting itself in knots trying to figure out what the established rules for jinn were, I realized that there were very few established rules that weren't immediately contradicted by other established rules, and sort of took it on myself to say, okay, then I'm going to create the version that exists in this story, and that'll, you know, I had to sort of take ownership in that way, which was sort of scary but also freeing, to create my own version of the jinn, of a genie.
Okay, so weird question. Which do you like better, the golem or the genie?
Oh, which do I like better? Oh, gosh. I don't know. In some ways, the golem seems like a slightly deeper personality just because she thinks and worries so much more than the genie does, and maybe that makes her, I don't know, maybe that's just my affinity, that she makes, you know, she's an anxious Jewish personality just like I am. On the other hand, the genie's a little more fun. The golem can be a stick in the mud, and it was very fun to write the genie and his various adventures and misadventures, and the way that he sort of takes it upon himself to be the bad boy every once in a while. I tried not to go too overboard with that because I think it's very easy to lose sympathy for the bad boy when they're being too bad. Everyone loves a rogue, so I sort of you know, let him play around with that a little.
Stick in the mud for a golem made out of mud.
Yeah, I know. I said that and immediately sort of cringed inside, but yeah.
It seemed to me that although you had fun writing this, you really were playing with a whole notion of personality and identity throughout. Am I reading that into it, or is that one of the interesting messages here?
Oh, no, that was very deliberate. And it was one of the reasons that I started writing the book. One of the reasons that I was drawn to my family stories and my husband's family stories in the first place was issues of identity, specifically around immigration and displacement, and the way that coming to another country, starting new but carrying the burdens of where you've been and of your history or the history of another place, the way that affects your identity and the way that you can end up feeling like a stranger everywhere. And so that, you know, by using these two characters, that really became heightened because, you know, unlike the rest of us who these are the things that we think about, you know, in the dark hours of the night or whatever, these two had to figure this stuff out just to make their way in the world and figure out how to interact. So it's sort of like taking an internal issue and externalizing it, which is, in my mind, one of the main purposes of this sort of fantastic fiction is to take an aspect of human nature and sort of blow it up and make it outsize and you know, an almost physical stumbling block as opposed to just sort of a, you know, subtle mental one.
How much of this story and the otherness of both characters, because they're both obviously, you know, completely unique creatures, how much of that comes from your own sense of otherness or your husband's sense of otherness? You mentioned he's an Arab American, and your the sort of otherness of your relationship.
Oh, good question. It's sort of, I think, hard to quantify. Certainly, this has been, you know, prevalent in my mind over the years. My husband and I have been together for a long time. We met when I was 18, and we've been together, you know, pretty much since then. So, you know, over half my life now, and I know his family and their stories almost as well as I know my own. And that has... It's been a major force in my life, sort of the, you know, my background and my feeling different when I was growing up, you know, just being Jewish. Either the, you know, I grew up in suburban Chicago, and it was north suburbs, sort of, back then it was almost considered the sticks, you know, this little town called Libertyville that's up near the northern border of Illinois. And, you know, so it wasn't, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners are in Chicago or familiar with Chicago, but it wasn't, you know, Skokie or the Gold Coast or any of that sort of where the schools closed down for the Jewish holidays. This was, you know, it did feel a little strange to be Jewish up there and, you know, to take your permission slip up to the teacher with the three other Jewish kids in class to say, you know, we're going to have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur off and all that. And so, you know, just that subtle otherness, it was very affecting, and it was for my husband as well, I know, just from talking with him, and, you know, feeling different because he was Arab American, and he would, especially, and then, you know, when the Gulf War started, you know, the first Gulf War, when he was in high school, and immediately sort of being made to feel very different. And so it's been a through line in our lives and in our families' lives as well. And we're both very proud of our identities and heritages. But there is always that sense of being a little off, a little different from everyone else. And I think that does play a major role, that I did sort of funnel all of that into this book.
There's a fair amount about sort of past lives. It's a, you know, it does become kind of a complex story. It starts out in many ways as a simple magic story and then gets more and more complicated. How did you feel pulling it all together at the end?
Oh, it was a long time. It took a long time to bring all those threads together. It was 7 years from start of book to, you know, editing and publication, and a lot of that time was spent just moving all the pieces around and trying to get them to fit together. When I finally wrote the ending, there was the first version of the ending, which was terrible, and I knew it was terrible, but I felt like I sort of had to write it to get it out of my system in order to sort of put down the preconceived notions of what was going to happen at the end of the book, and then go back and sort of refine it and streamline it and write the real ending of the book, which felt pretty triumphant. Once everything got figured out and it felt like a package that I could sort of tie up with a bow and send off to the publisher, then that it was a pretty big accomplishment, and I felt like I'd done the idea justice. I'd written the book sort of to my satisfaction, and then it could go off into the world now. So that was pretty awesome, actually.
Well, it's a delightful, interesting, complex story. It's called The Golem and the Genie. It's a great read as well. Look forward to it. What's your next project?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm honestly not certain right now. I've got a number of story ideas that I've sort of put to the side over the years, and I think now I need to, you know, as the work of getting the book out into the world is starting to die down, I need to pull up that list and see what still holds interest for me.
Thank you, Helene. Best of luck, The Gollum and the Genie, and you should read it. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Richard Agler, telling a personal story about the death of his daughter, Talia, how he and his wife, Mindy, have made a remarkable life into a force for good through organ donation and an orphanage in Africa. Don't miss this powerful story next Sunday. Our playout this morning comes from the CD Soldier Woman, and it's called The Bride, from a Canadian Jewish band called Jump Babylon. It's about playing weddings every weekend. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
This is the story of the weddings that we play, from a Montreal to Philly and a place along the way. The hall's not ready yet, but there's no time for no regret. Time to play a cocktail set. Whoa, 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 whoa. The groomie stays upstairs while the bride, she does her hair. A guest, he needs a chair. Oh, the bride, her face is wide beneath the candlelight. The groomie's shoes are tight. Oh, the ceremony has started. It's a solemn affair till the cousins come tumbling with their bare feet all up.